Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Matt Boswell, the lead pastor at Redemption Church in Duval, Washington. Pastor Matt has been on the show several times before in our ongoing series of interviews looking at the life of a small-town church. In one of our more fascinating interviews a few years back, we featured Matt talking about how he and a handful of devoted congregants were able to literally create a church within 1 week's time. We will link back to that podcast as well as other ones we did in our Redemption Church series that has featured discussions about growing and maintaining a religious organization, youth groups, and music ministry. Today, we will be talking about a rather popular and provocative blog post that Matt wrote about a month ago entitled, 10 Things Pastors Don't Want to Reveal. We will reveal them today, and we will link back to them on our website. We should also note that we are recording at Match Coffee and Wine in Duval, Washington, the host of several of our podcasts here. So if you're hearing ambient noise in the background, that is just ambient noise in the background. Matt, welcome back to Research on Religion. Long time no see.
I know, man. It's been too long, my friend. I haven't seen your good-looking mug now for a while. So.
So this is one of those things that congregants don't want to reveal all that much either. But I think in the past year, we've only been back to Redemption Church about two or three times.
I know, man. You're breaking my heart,
I know.
Dude. I miss the cowboy hat. I'm always looking for the cowboy hat. So
it's got to be there. And so I have to admit that it is pretty tough. Now, I got a kid who's going into high school. Mm-hmm. So he's a middle schooler right now, and he's got Boy Scouts, he's got Science Olympiad, sporting activities, all these different kinds of things. And so it's really difficult to kind of connect back to church and all. Either we're gone on Sundays, or sometimes we get back at 11 at night or midnight on Sunday, and you got a 13, 14-year-old in the house who just wants to sleep until 2 in the afternoon, right? So that must be something that you as a pastor see a lot, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty common feature, and I think particular to where we're at here in the Northwest. I mean, I think it's going to be true to any place in the country, but I think in the Northwest, I find, especially in the west side of Washington State, everybody's schedule is a bit more packed with a lot, right? So there's education, there's sports, there's extracurricular. And so I think the average schedule that I see here is just more dense in families than even when I was over on the east side of Washington State, like in Spokane. It seemed like people's lives were a little more slow-paced than I find over here.
Yeah, and I think that's one of these, you know, interesting life cycles. We try to make it to church as often as we can, but man, this past year has been pretty hectic. So, mm-hmm. And that's got to also wear on you as a clergy member, because somebody you see with a cowboy hat showing up every week is all of a sudden gone.
Right.
You're out there looking in the audience, where's that hat? Where's that hat? Where's that hat? And then all of a sudden you're like, that hat's no longer there. What am I doing wrong?
Right? Sure. Yeah. It can mean a number of things. You're wondering, are they still here, just busy? Are they not here and doing something else? Is it third? Did they get mad and they said, we're done, and you don't know what you did?
Yeah.
So it leaves a lot of, you know, where there is no story, one will be created. So I think in a pastor's mind, like 20 stories get created, you know, without the information, unless we try to go and find out what's going on or whatever else, which we're trying to even get better at that, at least within the church we're at. We try to, you know, improve on making a follow-up connection if we haven't seen somebody for a while and just like, hey, what's up? And then we get to find the story out one way or another.
Well, there's Google Glass now, so you can follow people around all the time and see what they're doing. Hey, where are you on Sunday? And, you know, we saw you out there Saturday at the bar. And
yeah, we're going to start taking our cues from the NSA or something like that, start figuring out how we can really track people. So
But this is one of those things, too, and I recognize this as a teacher at a university. You look over your students, and by the time it's fifth or sixth or seventh week, a third or maybe even a half of the class is not showing up, and you're always wondering, okay, what am I doing wrong? As you say, you envision about 20 different stories going through your head, and it might be something really horrible that's going on. It might not be anything.
Sure.
So
yeah.
That's something we're going to address today as we get into your list of things that pastors don't want to reveal as we get into your head. But since I haven't been around for about a year, I got to ask, hey, how have things been going at Redemption Church over the past year? Things growing, things changing, what's going on?
Kind of all of the above. So it's both growing and it's been changing. So our Carmen core values are all the same. None of that's really changed. We're pretty committed to who we are and understanding our identity. But in the last year, we made kind of a sizable staffing change. We had a guy that awesome guy, love him and everything else, but we knew kind of where we were going and what we needed to do. We needed to make a change in that area. And so we let him go, and then we had about a 5-month cycle where that was just vacant. And so we were just kind of holding down the fort with awesome people that were all volunteers. They did a phenomenal job stepping up to the plate and just making it happen. It was in the area of worship arts. And I can't even play the triangle, man. I have no musical skills, but I had to kind of oversee it for that season, working with the musicians. And by God's grace, because they're so gifted and talented, they just kind of ran with it, took the pieces and ran until we found kind of the person we felt God was leading us to bring onto the team. And so his name is Trent Maddox, just landed on our doorstep in early February. And officially got underway in this position at the 1st of March. And so he's just taken off, doing a great job, and really kind of taking us to places that we've never been before, particular to the worship art side of things. So that was a big, big change for us.
That's got to be something interesting for pastors to go through as well as personnel changes. Right?
Oh, it's probably one of the hardest things we do because, you know, these are, I think there's some guys in churches, particularly really big churches, where they may sort of see all of the staff around them more like employees. But I think when you're a church our size, those are friendships. These are people that you are doing life with. And when you come to that place where you know that that change is needing to occur for whatever series of reasons, it is just a really painful thing. And like in this case, you know, the guy that we had before is a wonderful man. I mean, like honestly, like it's one thing when you go, you know, it's a bad guy doing a good job or it's a good guy doing a bad job. And this was a good guy doing a good job, but we needed to kind of go to places in this that may not have necessarily been his personality wiring. And so we spent a lot of time talking about that and interacting, and it's never easy, you know. And the person that's hardest for is the guy going. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like how hard it was for me. That would be kind of narcissistic at that point. I think it was much harder for him. But it was certainly hard, you know, for me, for our elders that were all a part of those decisions too. That's a painful thing anytime, as well as the congregation has to kind of absorb that and go on a journey and that kind of thing too.
Let me backfill a little bit for folks who haven't been following the Redemption Church series, and we urge you to go back and link to some of the earlier podcasts, especially the very first one where they talk about how a church was built basically in 1 week's time. It's a pretty fascinating story. But Duval, Washington is a small rural town outside of Seattle, Washington. The population is probably about 7,000. You get the surrounding areas, you can get about to 10 or 12,000 or so. How big is the church?
So the church right now, we'll joke about the blog that I don't count. What I roughly know is that on Sunday morning, we probably have an average adult attendance of about 250 to 300, another attendance of children between 100 to 130. So you kind of wrap those two numbers together. But then we have the situation like what we were talking about with you. We have a lot more people that say, Redemption's my church. I sometimes make it. I sometimes don't make it. And so those numbers are somewhere between 600 and 700. People that say, I go there when I make it there. That's my church if something else isn't in the schedule. And so, you know, there's kind of the congregational Sunday number, and then there's those who claim Redemption as their church number. And we don't focus, we have membership, it's important to us, but we don't really measure ourselves by membership numbers. We really look at those who claim Redemption as their church.
And it's an interesting church as well. It's a non-denominational church.
Correct.
And it meets in a high school.
And it meets in a high school.
And it's still meeting in a high school.
And it's still meeting in a high school right now. And you know, we think that probably hopefully the next couple of years, you know, assuming that, you know, that still is something that's available to us, we'll keep doing that. We're now beginning to seriously consider our options, you know, because we know that, I mean, we have a great relationship with the school. They're amazing. The whole community of Duval has been great for Redemption Church, opened up their businesses to us, opened up the school to us. I mean, it's been a phenomenal kind of experience in that way. But we know those sayings have a shelf life, too. Mm-hmm. And so we've been now in existence for 2.5 years. You know, we go, is that really going to be something that we can be a part of 3 years from now? Maybe. You know what I mean? But, you know, things change. Policies change. You know, there's no telling what can occur in the future. So I think we're really having to look now, like, okay, what do we need to do to generate an opportunity for a place that we'd plant the flag in mm-hmm. a more permanent way?
And that is something that we're going to keep our eyes on, because it's really neat seeing this church grow from its essential birth within 1 week throughout this whole process. So you mentioned another thing here, that it's not just a church that meets in an auditorium every Sunday, but there are other things. You have events out in the community, and you do Christmas caroling on Christmas Eve. You're going around in a flatbed truck around neighborhoods right. and that. So there's a lot of different things you do there. But you also have a blog now.
And
this is a very interesting thing for a lot of churches to reach out for people who don't go to church very often or who can't make it to church. They can oftentimes see sermons or do other things. You call this blog Pastor Matt TV.
Yes.
So Pastor Matt TV is now on the air. It's been going, what, for 1-2 months now or so?
Yeah, like a month and a half, I think, somewhere in there. Yeah.
All right, and this is where you posted your provocative article.
Correct.
Now this is pretty awesome, because most people put up a blog, and I largely think of blogs as emailing yourself, right?
That's correct.
And I'm on the web, right? I got a web presence. And 80 billion other people on the planet, even though there's only 7 billion people. But here's what's very cool. You wrote this article called 10 Things Pastors Don't Want to Reveal, and you got... roughly, I think, in the first couple of days, about over 100,000 hits, and you're up to 190,000 hits on that?
Yeah, so matter of fact, this very hour 2 weeks ago is when I posted it. So it was Wednesday, this hour 2 weeks ago. And since that time, it's received over 190,000 hits.
Wow. Yeah. So that's a lot. So all you 190,000 people, come visit Research on Religion. Hopefully we'll get linked back there. And I was going to ask you if you've kind of looked at where this audience is coming from, right? I mean, let's first back up a minute and say, is Pastor Matt TV devoted for just the Redemption Church crowd, or is it broader? What was the original intent
right.
here?
Yeah, it was really, I mean, this is what's going to sound really ridiculous. The original intent was, I wrote a paper on, I wanted to address helping parents deal with sons and what I call the porn apocalypse, right? Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to help parents know how they could help guide their young, you know, their 10-year-old to 18-year-old boys' technology in relationship to pornography. So I wrote this paper. It was 12 pages long. I'm like, if I print this off and hand it out at church on Sunday, nobody's going to read it because it's 12 pages long.
Yeah, and it's going to go in the wastebasket
right, exactly.
as people walk
so
by.
Yeah, I'm like, so if I broke it into 5 parts and posted it on a blog, maybe they would read it. So the whole start of the blog was merely I wrote this paper and I wanted to find a better way to transmit it to the people at Redemption Church. So that's how it started. The other part of it was I'd been playing around for a while with trying to get back to writing on a consistent basis anyway. So I'm like, well, I'll just start it and then it will create the discipline for me to try to, like, once a week just write. So in some ways it was almost personal, reflective, therapeutic.
Emailing yourself.
Emailing myself. That's a brilliant way of putting it. I mean, that is legitimately what it was. Like, once the article on porn was over, I didn't really have any master plan. It was just, I'll just write something once a week and we'll see what comes of that. And people read it, great. If not, great. It's just a good discipline for me. So it was that naive in some ways.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you got 190,000 hits here on this interesting post that we're going to go into in a second. Where are all these folks coming from? There's not 190,000 people at Redemption Church, nor in Duval.
No.
Even though we have a Froegurt stand now.
we're pretty sophisticated
now,
right?
We have frozen yogurt in Duval now. So.
Yeah, so I think we've got, what now, 3 traffic lights or something like
three
that?
3 traffic lights, yeah.
We're
frozen
big time.
Yogurt. Yeah.
We're big time. So, no, but, you know, it's interesting because behind the scenes you can see a lot, obviously, with a blog like that. And so when it first opened up, it was a lot of the United States and then bled into Canada and then kind of really hit over in the UK. And then from there, it's really spread. We've had people post on it or whatever in places like China, in Africa. Some missionaries in different parts of the world have picked it up, shared it with other missionaries, and that kind of thing. Because, you know, pastors and missionaries have a lot of commonality and a lot of the same insecurities or frustrations. And so it, and then it just kept going viral. So now, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many countries, you know, India, just a lot of different places it ended up hitting.
And you've even gotten big name people looking at this thing and talking about, like Lee Strobel, the guy who wrote The Case for Christ.
Right, yeah, and a guy named Alan Hirsch wrote The Forgotten Ways, you know, big leadership book guy, and, you know, he was talking about, I mean, so yeah, it was really strange to have that experience.
It must be, because you're here in the middle of podunk town, Nowheresville, and, you know, you walk out and, you know, you got a lot of trees and mold all around you, and all of a sudden Lee Strobel's talking about you, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, it is, and especially I think because the blog was so new in general for me, like it just had started it, and writing those 10 things was, I don't think they're that novel. I think there's thousands of pastors could have wrote that 10 point blog. I think I was just happened to be the guy that actually did it and was dumb enough to post it, and then it kind of had a life of its own from there.
Well, let's dig into that. And the 10 points are, you say they're pretty common sense, and I would agree with this because I have the exact same thoughts and feelings and insecurities, I would guess you'd say, in the process of teaching as well. So our professions are very similar in many regards, and so I think it's kind of cool.
The fact on that was funny. I was talking to a friend of mine over the weekend on Saturday, and he owns like a financial consulting firm, and he's actually on CNN. I mean, he's a known guy, and he says, Matt, you know what? These 10 points, I have these same challenges in my company. This is the way I feel in my company. And I had another guy that's an entrepreneurial guy, started a company that's all over the world, and he weighed in and said, this is true to anybody that is a leader, that is entrepreneurial in spirit and wants to see something grow. These are going to be the exact same challenges. So I agree with you. I think they're universal to different fields. Just there's maybe different ways we have to interact with them.
Well, let's dig into this because these things are great. So we'll start and just go down the list. And since I first saw this up on your website, you've also written a response piece, which is, I don't know what to call it, the solutions to the 10 best things, or my personal thoughts on how I deal with these 10 things. So I will let you give you a chance to talk about each of these points, what your initial thought was, and then basically how you deal with it. So let's kind of go here. The number one thing, okay, that pastors do not want to tell their congregants or don't want to reveal, maybe even to themselves.
Oh, yeah. No, that's an excellent insight. We don't want to say it to ourselves. We certainly don't want to say it to the people we work with. We don't want to say it to our friends, fellow pastors down the road. We don't want to say it to the church. We don't want to say it to anybody. Probably the only person that ever hears every once in a while when we get really depleted is our spouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But then if you put it on a blog, nobody will hear about it. Except for 190,000 of your closest friends. All right. So here's the first one. We take it personally when you leave the church. Discuss.
Right. Yes. You know, it was funny. This point, actually, this whole 10 points was born out of a completely different blog I was writing. And I was writing on the 5 lame reasons people leave churches, right? So there was this really popular article a couple of months ago that went viral on, you know, 5 bad reasons that people leave churches. And I read it, and I'm like, it's incomplete. There's another 5 that aren't just bad, but they're lame, right? So I start to write these lame reasons, and then I realize that, you know, what I think are lame reasons for people, that's only 50% of the issue. The other part of it is, I'm just hurt by this. The other part is, I'm starting to, you know, have a, you know, whether it be a bitter spirit or frustrated spirit or whatever. So the problem isn't just that it's lame, but that I'm also ungracious in their lame thing, right? So then I start to get real honest with myself. So I put that in another Word document. Oh, yeah, I should talk about my problem with this, you know? And then that kind of grew from there. But I think this particular point, I think it is universal to almost any pastor I've ever met, that it just, it's hard, or it hurts, or it's frustrating when people leave. Now, that doesn't mean when every person leaves that it's always those emotions. I think there are some people that leave that honestly a pastor's like, thank you. You know what I mean? Oh man, it's finally over, you know? Yeah. And there's gonna be that truth, you know, because for whatever reason they were clearly not in your camp, or there was always an issue, and you're grateful in some ways to see them go because, you know, you didn't like the friction and they didn't like it either. I think there's other times where people leave and they let you know why, and you get it. It just makes sense. And you can actually be happy for them even though you're kind of bummed yourself. But I think the category of just when it just hurts and they just vanish, or the reason they give, you're like, come on, help us solve that. Don't just leave. Help us fix that. I think that one sticks a lot more in the minds of pastors when it happens.
How frequent is that? Is this something you wrestle with every month? Is it just a couple times a year?
I would say, you know, I think every time a person leaves kind of in that last category I talked about, where you're like, really, that's your reason? Or come on, stick it out with this. Or man, just tell me what's going on. Don't just vanish and ignore me when I try to get a hold of you. I think you're going to have that feeling almost every time you have that occurrence. Now, it may not be a long, you know, painful process. You know, like in my world now, when that happens, it bothers me for about a day.
Oh.
And then by the next morning, I'm like, okay, whatever, I'm moving on, right?
Okay.
Now, when I first started in pastoral ministry, it would bother me for months, right? You know, and so I think over the course of time, you grow and mature and you kind of realize the big picture more. Occasionally, there's somebody that pulls out that was really critical to what you do as a church, and maybe even were like, that was my friend. That one will sting longer. You know, because you in that sense, you do feel very betrayed. Like, wait, I thought we were buddies. I thought you were in this with me. I thought we were going to go to long haul. And now you've just cut it all off, you know. And that one, that could go on for weeks or even months sometimes, where you feel just like, I don't know how to interact with you now because you split from something that I've poured all of my heart and soul into. And so it's just more deeply personal at that level.
I'll give you a little insight on this, too, given that we haven't been to church all that often in the past year. It nags at the congregants, too, because every Sunday, you know, we get up and we're like, are we going to church? No, we're not. Well, if I see Pastor Matt walking down the street, he's going to give me the stink eye, you know, so I got to make sure I pull my hat down really low over my eyes so he can't see me and I can't see him. So, there's this mutual thing, too, is that I'm wondering if, you know, the pastor's really worried about me, and so I mean actually this blog was a chance for me to reach back and say,
yeah,
everything
awesome.
Is cool. It's just my kid is sleeping till 2 p.m right? Okay. So how do you deal with something like this? You mentioned now that you're better at you know, just let it roll off your back. That's easy to say, but is there any kind of solution to the fact that people are walking out and you feel bad about that?
Right. Well, I think there's a couple of different things. I think one is, and this is maybe in the bigger picture, if you start to see a lot of exoduses all at the same time, we've never had that. We'll have one, you know, every couple of months or something like that. And we're like, oh, okay, well, you know, is something going on that we need to know about, right? So I think part of it is just evaluation of the church at large. Is there something not right? Are people mad about something? Did we miscall something and we need to patch it up or whatever? So I think that's one thing you can do is just ask the question, is there a reason people are leaving? I think the other goes back to something we said earlier, where there isn't a story, one will be created. So as much as we can go back and find the story, because a lot of people will just disappear, right? Because I think there's a good way to leave a church and there's a bad way. The good way is to say, hey, we love you guys, but we're leaving. Honestly, that's a good way, because at least you got the story. The bad way is you just vanish. And then what was it, you know? But I think, therefore, what we've tried to do is to try to contact those people and say, so what was it? That way we can just know one way or another,
yeah,
good, bad, and different. We can put to rest the question marks. And so I think that is a helpful thing. Go find out why they split, you know? And I would say maybe 50% of the time they'll take your call, and 50% of the time they won't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, caller ID. That's Pastor So-and-so. I'm not talking to you. Know, and so, but I think it's good to do that. And then the other thing, and this is kind of what my response was in ways that I try to be sanctified through these 10 things. I don't think the 10 can be solved, but I think we can become more mature in relationship to the 10. And, you know, mine is just telling myself, you know what, this is going to pass. Your feelings on this will pass. And it's not going to do you any good to get bitter at that person, or to, you know, from now on speak poorly of them to somebody. You know, it's just not, there's no benefit in that whatsoever. So just let it go as best as you can and focus more on the people that are still at the church and focus on the people you're trying to reach through the church. and don't get us caught up in the person that just split from the church.
That's a very common problem that I see in teaching, and you mentioned a very good way of dealing with this. When we get student evaluations back, I always tend to focus on the one or two that really hate the class.
Right,
Not the 190 that love the class, right? You know, and that overwhelms, and you just got to sit back and say, you know what? As life goes on, there's going to be people who like things and don't like things, and you just got to focus on you know, the ones that like it, and the ones who really don't like it, if they can't be reached out to, they can't be reached out to onwards and forwards.
Right, right.
And so let's do that. Let's go move onwards and forwards with number two. Number two, and I relate to this one as well, things that pastors don't want to reveal is that they feel pressure to perform week after week. What's that one about?
Yeah, that one is, I think it has a lot of layers to it. And I think part of it is because depending on the demographic of the church, but like for Redemption, you have everything from a junior higher sitting in the service all the way up to an 85-year-old retiree. Mm-hmm. And so you're casting a really broad net, and you're trying to hold all their attention at the same time, and you're trying to say something that's going to help the non-believer, the new believer, the old believer, the make-believer, all of that. And you're trying to say something to all of them and have it be compelling enough that they stick with you and compelling enough that they want to come back. And I think that creates just a really – I mean – It just creates a unique burden because you feel like I have to be a mass appeal communicator. And especially in a culture nowadays where everything's so niche, right? Mm-hmm. You have niche music and niche movies and indie projects and all of this, and suddenly you're trying to be a mass appeal. Well, the way mass appeal works is multi-million-dollar budgets or celebrity personality or whatever else. So I think a church, again, like a Redemption then, and I think a lot of churches and a lot of pastors then feel that pressure of, how do I even come close to doing this? I've got to be able to, quote, compete at the level of what everybody's inundated with all the time. And so, you know, you can build that up in your head pretty substantially, and you can feel the weight every week of, all right, how many jokes can I find to put in here? How many little morsels of bumper stickerisms can I have? And, you know, that kind of thing, and get really lost in that sometimes. And that's the risk, is you're more concerned on the marketability than on the message. And I think that becomes the tension, you know?
It's got to be a little bit of the message, too, because I know there's times where you leave a lecture for me or probably a sermon for you that you say, well, I really nailed that one. I really got some deep insight there. You know, over the past week, I've been working on this. I found something really unique to say, and a lot of people came up afterwards and said, oh, man, never thought about it that way. That's awesome. And then you think about next week, you know, there might be a little dry spell there.
Oh, totally.
Right? And yeah. I have to admit that the first time that I came to Redemption Church, and it wasn't Redemption Church back then, but it was the first time that I saw you pastoring, there was this, you did a series on good and evil in the Bible, and that was awesome. I mean, it was like one of the best sermon series I've ever seen. It's all been kind of downhill since then. but you know, you come through and you go, wow, I really nailed it. And it's not a million-dollar production process, but you just all the pieces fall together, and you feel really good. Now that all of a sudden seems to be the next standard, and then you worry about, well, if I let down a little bit, am I going to lose people?
Right.
You know, say...
Yeah, that's absolutely the case, right? I mean, the worst Sunday is an awesome Sunday.
Yeah, because you know next week is going to be tough.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was a little bit like, you know, this blog is a great example of it. So I write one on 10 things pastors hate to admit publicly, and it, you know, just goes viral.
Yeah, you got 190,000.
And then the worst thing is my next blog.
Yeah, it's going to draw 127.
Hey, like my mom checked it out. That was awesome. My mom and my wife read it. That's fantastic. I got two. That's great. So, yeah, so you feel then like, how do I keep creating these mountain peaks?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can create a real beast in your own heart and mind to where you're chasing as opposed to just trying to enjoy and focus on what you're trying to do.
How forgiving do you think some of the congregants are when it comes to that? Like, again, when I saw that first Good and Evil one, I'm like, oh, you know, this was awesome. All the pieces fell together. But, you know, in my profession, I know you can't have, you know, the most awesome presentation all the time. So I'm a little bit forgiving on that. It's like, okay, this is a more kind of basic sermon this week. It's not as fancy. There might not be as many insights. Yeah, we're going to do the, you know, typical Easter story or Christmas story again and again. And,
right.
Okay, I get it. But are congregants forgiving on that?
Yeah,
do you think you lose some folks because you don't?
I don't think so for the most part. Matter of fact, I would venture to say that I think churches lose congregants nowadays less for the inability of the pastor to be able to perform week after week. I think that's, again, it's a monster that the pastor creates in his head. I think it's less a criticism of congregants. I think congregants increasingly are leaving churches for the amenities of larger churches and less for purely the message content. In fact, you know, we've had people that have left Redemption to go to larger churches with a lot of amenities and even said, but the message isn't that deep or good, so we'll keep going and watching you online. I mean, you know, which I'm like, I don't know what to say to that. You know, like, thanks, I guess. sure, you know. And so I think congregations are pretty forgiving of you know, the inability of a pastor to nail it every week. At the same time, I do think sometimes guys get worn out and they get kind of lazy to try to put their best effort in. You know, they get wounded, or they're just whatever it is, and then it can become problematic because people can start to tell whether you're trying or you're not trying.
Are you ever get the is there ever a temptation to do reruns?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, Good and Evil is getting reran.
Oh well, I'm gonna have to come back for that because now that was like 4 years ago or so.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, so it was one of those where, you know, we've seen enough changeover and different people and everything else that it was like, yeah, we can do this again. It will be different than the way it was done the first time, but it's the same basic idea. And I think there's a value to that too. Apparently, you know, the Bible writers thought it was good to have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know what I mean? Because like, oh, let's tell it's a different way, same story. And I think there is real value for churches to do that every once in a while.
No, I think that's true too. I often, you know, having done one of my classes about 25, 26 times now already, you feel a little bit burnt out and tired, and you go like, doesn't everybody already know this stuff? But then you realize, no, they haven't. And even when you do it, you find some new insights along the way too. So how do you deal with the pressure to perform week after week?
You know, I think there's a couple of things for me. I think the biggest one is more a macro issue than a micro issue. I can sense in my own spirit when I'm getting that competitive nature. I'll start to look at another church that's down the road or across the way or over the hill or wherever it is, and I'll be like, oh man, we gotta up our game. We gotta do this and this and this, you know. And as soon as I realize I'm feeling a competition with the dude down the street, is when I realize, whoa, this is more about me now. This isn't about Jesus. This is about me. This is about me getting some worth that isn't mine to take. And so then I intentionally try to back off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just, okay, I'm not going to chase right now. And that's, again, it's a mental process and game. It's a lot of prayer, like, Jesus, help me. I'm feeling it. I'm feeling like I need to nail the next one because I'm concerned what people think of me. Help me, because I know that's going to be feeding the beast in such a way that you'll just get worse, you know, and you'll create more unnecessary pressure. So I just try to pray it through a lot. I try to remind myself, hey, man, you're trying to chase right now. Don't chase. Consciously stop doing that. And just reminding myself of get back in the saddle, get back to what you know and what you can do, and don't try to be something you're not, and don't try to become some other guy's thing. That's what they're called to do. It's not what you're called to do. So I just try to walk myself through that as much as possible, which is usually about 50 or 60 speeches, you know, in about a 4-day period.
Oh, yeah. And late at night, too, at 2 in the morning when you're staring at the ceiling.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you feel competitive pressure from the big church down the road, so to speak. Is it ever an inspiration, though? Do you ever look down and say, oh, man, you know, I can't compete with that, or and then you turn that into a, you know what, we could do something like that. Maybe not exactly, but you know, oh, I like the way they're running their youth program, or they did this kind of cool thing. Because a lot of people, when I talk about competition and how businesses compete with one another, and how even churches, and you kind of admit this, you kind of compete with one another for this. It's not negative sum. It's not their gain is your loss, but sometimes their gain inspires you to increase your game.
Yeah, I think there's kind of two edges to competition, right? So one is the healthy type that makes you go, how can we get better? And we certainly experience that, because what's interesting about Duval is we've estimated that about 50% of church-going people that live in Duval leave Duval to go to church. So they'll go to Redmond, or they'll go to, you know, Monroe, or they'll go to Kirkland or something like that. So about 50% go out, 50% stay. And then of the 50%, you have, I think, now 5 evangelical churches, a Catholic church, a Mormon church, you know, so kind of gets divvied out from there. And we look at some of those churches that people leave Duval to go to, and we love them. You know, there's times that people will leave our church to go to one of those churches, and I'm like, I get it. They're great. We love them, right? And so we can learn from them. We admire them, we appreciate them, that kind of thing. But I think the other part is the negative side of the competition of, well, hey, we do want to try to do some of that here, but if you split, you can't help us do that. And so can we keep you so you can help us see that get accomplished? So I think it's both ends of it. And so I don't want to sound like competition is purely the negative side or we don't like the guy over the hill down the street or in the next community. Some of them, honestly, I think there are certain values that each church holds. And I do think you look at other churches that sometimes your people go to and you go, man, they... why did you do that? You know what I mean? It's not so much personal at that point. Yeah. It's a deeper than that. You know, it may be a little bit more pure, at least as you see it, because you go, of all the places you could go, that's where you went.
Yeah.
How about I just send you down the street another block? Because those guys are awesome, you know? Yeah. And so there's some of that too.
Yeah. Oh, and I know in the past too, you've done church tours. You've gone around and all throughout the state and done that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But let's move on. Let's do number three. So we got our first two here. Number three is you, and this is a surprising one, and I don't know if I necessarily experienced this one in my teaching career, but it is interesting from your point. We struggle with getting our worth from ministry. Mm-hmm. What is that about?
A lot of guys will say that ministry can become like an idol, right? So in other words, you're supposed to be doing ministry for Jesus, but you start doing ministry for you, for your ego, for your sense of self-worth, for people to give you the pat on the back. I think a lot of guys get into ministry, especially the upfront communicator guys. And part of the draw to that is you're on a stage, you're in the spotlight. I'm not trying to say all of that is, purely inappropriate, but I think there can be that, man, I'm going to be kind of famous, at least for this nucleus of people right here. And you can, again, you start to feed on that and you start to say like, hey man, this is what makes me tick. This is where I get my praise. Because especially in the home, in the home, it's like, well, that's just dad. That's just husband. But a congregation, well, that's the pastor, And so it can really puff up your ego too. And then when it's not going well, when you're not getting the pat on the back, when you're not getting the email on Monday that says, thank you.
Yeah.
When you feel like things are kind of slouching a little bit, then your balloon deflates and you're like, nobody likes me, and why am I here?
That feeds right back to that first point.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's that worth part of it that I think pastors sometimes struggle with,
And that is really interesting, because when I read that one on your blog, you say, we struggle with getting our worth from ministry. I think a lot of people, the congregants included, but just even folks that don't go to church, say, wow, that must be a profession that you really do get a lot of worth from, right? You're thinking big thoughts and deep ethical concerns all the time. That, man, that just must be a total fill all the time, right?
Well, and there's some good parts in that, right? So I think we can say there's the healthy side of saying, man, it's really fulfilling to do ministry. But there's this other side that says my ego is starving for the attention of ministry. And that's the dark side of it, right? Where, again, it's way more about me getting filled up more than it's about me feeling fulfilled. And I think there's kind of an edge in there that's a little different. When I see people doing something that's worthwhile and they're loving it, I think God loves that.
Yeah.
But I think a pastor can almost be like, yeah, whatever, Jesus. All right, now I'm in the light. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's the darker side of it.
And I think you see that a lot with a lot of these televangelists or these folks that, really get famous and for their pastorate and stuff, that it oftentimes leads to some things that are not what you would think pastors are doing. That's true with everything. I see in my own profession, you get a lot of people surrounding you saying, oh, this is great, you're doing great, and a lot of yes men around you, and that alters the way that you think about what you're doing and what your responsibilities to others happen to be. How do you deal with that?
The biggest thing for me is when I start to notice it, because I start to get discouraged. That's always like the meter in my mind is, well, I'm really down. Matter of fact, my favorite day when I'm down is Monday, because it's as far away from Sunday as humanly possible. And if I wake up discouraged and it didn't fill me up, that's when I know that, man, I'm really looking at me a lot. I'm staring at myself a ton. And the best way for me to get out of that is start elevating others around me to get my gaze off of me. By celebrating, hey man, this guy did this, or that guy did that, or I'll do any number of things. I'll praise our eldership on Facebook, or I'll go into the office and be like, you guys are doing awesome, or, you know, talk to some of our lay leadership in the church and encourage them. And so I just realized that the more I see God doing something in the lives of those around me, the more I'm not paying attention to myself. It's a derivative of counseling I give to people that are struggling with depression. You know, when we have somebody come in, it's, oh, I'm just really down, I have a lot of anxiety, I'm really depressed. We encourage them to go serve people less fortunate than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they're not looking at themselves. And they're looking at others that are hurting, and then they can make the investment into them, and they're like, oh, I feel better, you know? And so it's just the same concept for me applied to the people around me.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. It's seeing some of your students succeed. That's always very good. It's interesting, too, how you know, we get this in our profession. You see somebody else at work get a certain accolade, and you're like, well, what about me? I got something, too. And I feel that pressure all the time because we're, you know, other than Hollywood and politicians, I think academia gives themselves more awards than anybody else. But it's very difficult to deal with, and it's a human trait. The pastorate, they're regular people, and, you know, they're not immune from original sin or anything like that. It's
right.
Tough. Envy and all that other stuff comes into play.
Well, and I think that's one of the things, as I was kind of reflecting on this and thinking about how these points are going to be true to different fields, but I think what maybe separates out the pastorate from the other fields is everybody looks at the pastorate and says, but you should know better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're supposed to be above all of this. You're supposed to have solved it. You're close to God. You know these are wrong, and you shouldn't have these emotions. And so, you know, even like in the responses to the post, there was people at times kind of scolding, like, don't you realize it's Jesus' church and you should just let it go? And I'm like, thanks, Sherlock. I mean, of course I know it's Jesus' church and I should let it go. I mean, this is why we don't want to admit these things. So, you know, if an entrepreneur struggles with this, everybody will be like, well, I get it. Right. It's competition. Da, 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 da. Yeah. When a pastor says it, whoa. Wait a minute, should that guy be a pastor then? And I think there is a humanist forgotten in some of that, which is why a lot of guys won't admit it to any source.
Right.
Because they're you know, a board could be like, should this guy still be leading us at this point?
Yeah, that's because you're all supposed to have, you know, shiny halos floating around you and that big glow. And we oftentimes forget that our pastors are human too. Let's go to number four. And this number four might relate to number three, two, and one, which is, pastors regularly think about quitting.
Yeah.
What's the deal there?
It's twofold. You know, one aspect of it is we think of quitting because it's the only job I know of where the entire family is directly related to the job description. In other words, if, you know, almost in the other field, your marriage comes apart, you're going to keep your job. You know, maybe as a politician, you might eventually not win the next election,
mm-hmm.
you know, but nobody's getting run out of office for a divorce,
mm-hmm.
right? But a pastor's losing his job over a divorce.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? So
that.
Now the wife is in the job description. The marriage is in the job description. In a lot of church environments, if one of your kids goes off the rails substantially and publicly, you're probably going to lose your job if they're under your roof, right? So now the kids are in the job description. And so from that, there's a unique pressure on pastoral families that I think sometimes pastors feel that pressure or they're even told. I mean, it's amazing how many things get said about pastors' wives or kids publicly by a lot of people that are just, you know, they're just either gossips or mm-hmm. insensitive or whatever. And I think from that, pastors go like, you know what? I don't want to keep doing this. I don't want my whole family to be on the front lines. I want to go to a job where maybe at the Christmas party they meet my wife. You know what I mean? And they're not judging her except, did she have a nice dress? You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? And so I think that's one aspect of it, is wanting to quit just to get out of that spotlight.
That's a great point, too. Yeah. I had never really thought about that, but that really makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, matter of fact, I would say the number one response I've probably had in the blog has been from pastors' wives or kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, saying, yep, totally, get it, right? And so I think that burns out and blows out more pastors than probably any other topic. And so that's one aspect. The other aspect is, you know, the kind of goes back to one of the earlier ones when it comes to the ego side of it. So if you're really doing awesome and you're nailing it every week and people are loving it and the church is growing, you can get so proud that you go, you know what, I think I deserve a bigger church.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to quit this and go to the next big dog on the rung, right? So the pride can set in sometimes. You go, I'm too good for this little place. I need a big city with a big church and a big budget. So I think that can happen. Or on the flip, you're not nailing it. It's falling apart. People maybe aren't as enthusiastic. It's kind of stale. And you go, I stink. I should just go someplace else and start over, right? So those are also features of the we think about quitting. You know, I'm not – not doing it, or I'm doing it so well, or I just want to get out of the limelight. All of those are reasons sometimes that we think about it.
So there it sounded like you're quitting to go to another church, but is there any quitting just to get out of the pastorate entirely?
Yes. So that first point of I want my family out of the spotlight.
That's
the
right.
I'm just going to go sell insurance, or I'm going to go do whatever. I just don't want to be in this anymore. I think there's other reasons. Certainly, guys just completely quit. Mm-hmm. I think some become burned out.
Yeah.
You know, it's just especially solo guys. You know, guys are environments where they're the heptathlete for Jesus, and they're having to have all the disciplines in the local church, including cleaning the bathrooms. You know, mm-hmm. those guys can get worn down over the course of time, and so I think they'll sometimes be a little more prone to finally just do something different. And I think also there's some guys that honestly over the course of time they just admit that they're not that spiritual. And I don't mean that like in a slam way. You know, I had a couple of guys email on this and say, another thing the pastors don't like to admit is they become atheist and stay in their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That was like number 11 a couple of guys sent me behind the scenes. You know, and there is a whole sub-community of people staying in pastoral ministry that aren't even believers, but that's where they have their Bible degree. That's where they have their seminary. They made a 7-year investment academically. What are they going to go do?
And see, that's the solution I thought would be to this, is if you have that thought of quitting, one of the solutions is to open up the Help Wanted page and say, well, we need computer programmers, insurance salesmen. It's
right.
Like, I don't know how to do that.
Right. That's not where I put my eggs, man. Yeah. So what am I going to do now? You know, which a lot of them go into insurance, selling insurance or selling houses, or because they're good with people.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can make good pitches. And again, I say that with the utmost respect, that's where they end up going, a lot of them.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. So, and anything else too that helps to alleviate this problem?
I put in the follow up that when I am tempted to quit, I actually quit. You know, so I don't send in my letter of resignation, but I actually, and I've only had a couple of times in all of my 20 years where I'm like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this, and so I actually take a couple of weeks. I'm taking some time off, and then from there, it's really kind of the test of. After a couple of weeks, do I go, I'm kind of missing this. I like this. Or if it's, man, this is nice. I don't want to go back, right? And if I ever came to the point of I don't want to go back, I think that's when I'd have to do an honest, serious sit down with my wife. Let's evaluate this. Because I don't want to stay and not want to be there. You know, I know there are occurrences where people do this in ministry. They don't want to be there, but they stay because what else are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? If I ever came to that point, I would like to hope I wouldn't just stay anyway. I'd like to hope that the values that I hold that says I should stop, I would actually stop. But at least I test it with taking off a few weeks to see if I want to come back to it or if I'm done with it. And so far, I've never been done with it.
Yeah.
So, I'm like, after about a week, I'm like, we could do this thing at church. We could do that thing at a message. And then I'm like, all right, ready to get back to it. I clearly like this still.
Let's move on to number 5 here. And so far, you've been very transparent in this interview. But here's number 5. Number 5, you say, pastors say they are transparent, but they're actually opaque. What's that one about?
It was funny, actually. I've always been probably overly transparent. I've crossed that line a ton of times where we get the email on Monday. You went too far. You said too much. You're far too open. And I use that word opaque because literally we had somebody one time went to one of our other pastors and said, Matt is far too transparent. He needs to become opaque.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, so it was like, oh, that's a good line right there. I'll use that.
I got to stop you here. Did your kids ever say that?
No, like, my kids are hilarious.
Oh, dude, because I would think that, your kids come back and say, you're using me too much in the sermons. What are you crazy?
Well, that's one of my rules. I every time I use my wife or kids, I ask for their permission in advance.
Yeah.
You know, because it goes back to that whole, they're under the spotlight. They're already going to be potentially judged at some level by people. I don't want to exacerbate the problem. So I go to them and say, hey, can I tell the story about when you were 5 and you whatever it was? And, yeah, it's fine. Even recent things I've used that I ask them for that permission. So I don't put them in the firing line unless they're already totally aware and give me 100% approval for it. But I still end up choosing to be much more transparent than maybe a lot of my contemporaries, and for good or bad. The great thing for me is I'm in a church that totally gets it. I mean, just totally gets it. And so they're very loving toward me and forgiving me, so I have the flexibility. I mean, literally, if I wasn't at Redemption Church, I don't know if I would have posted this blog even. You know what I mean? Like, I'm in an environment where they could read it and go, oh, that's Matt. Yeah, of course, that's Thank you, Matt.
Matt being transparent again.
There's Matt pulling a stunt, you know, that kind of thing. So they're amazing for that, and I'm appreciative of it. But I still think that there are places where pastors should be opaque. They really should. And I think sometimes if we're being transparent to solicit pity, I don't know if that's healthy always. I think if we're transparent to help people understand, like, hey, I'm on the journey too, and we're all in this together, and we're all human in the process, that's great. But sometimes guys become transparent because they are looking for a pity party, or they're transparent to vent their frustrations, which isn't always healthy. And I also think, ultimately, pastors are leaders, and sometimes you have to have a stiff upper lip. If the church is going to do something that you're kind of afraid of, you still got to look like you're not afraid. And that's the opaque part of it that they should maintain. But I also think because of the wife and because of the kids and things like that, some guys are much more opaque or boldly non-transparent.
Even, yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, they're just worried. What are people going to think? What are they going to say? How are they going to judge? You know, that kind of thing. And so I think there's more probably of that in a lot of churches where a guy's like, you know, I show you a little bit of me, but I don't show you too much because I'm not sure how you're going to swallow it.
Yeah.
You know?
There's two things that you mentioned in transparency that I think are interesting, and I just noticed this when you were talking. One is transparency to say, I'm sharing the journey, right, for pastors that say, hey, I've struggled with this thing, and this is how I dealt with it, which is actually very useful for congregants because you look at that and say, you know, here's this guy. He's got the glowing halo around him. He's never had to be in my shoes and deal with these. And all of a sudden, he is too. And here's the step-by-step nuts and bolts way he's dealt with that. I think that's very useful. And I use that technique in class, too, that I say, well, this is a concept that I apply in my life, and this is how I've had to learn it, and I've struggled with trying to figure this out. And so you can empathize with the students, and there's a bigger connection there. But there's that other aspect is that, you know, you're having a lousy day and you come in a little bit, you know, grumpy and the steam is coming out your ears and you can see that. And that's might not be all that useful because then there's the pity party, but there's also people just don't want to deal with that. Right. They, you know, you're the one that we're supposed to be coming for help. And if you're all grumpy all the time, what good are you? So how do you deal with that? I want to just toss this out to you. Do you ever, and I do this in my classes, too, because I use personal stories, but they're somewhat transparent but somewhat opaque because I create different caricatures.
Right.
That, you know, I know something happened to this person. I'm not going to use their name, but I'm going to kind of impose this on my life to illustrate a certain point.
Right.
And then you kind of ground that in your personal life. And in many ways, it's very caricature or cartoonish in that regard.
Right.
Is there any of that you
think about? Yeah, I think, I mean, because again, you know, if your ultimate heart is to help people along in growing in some way or dealing with some problem, you know, you might take something of your life and use components of it. You're not telling the whole story or, you know, the whole aspect, or it's not a complete unveiling of every part of it, but it's enough to be able to then communicate the point or help them to understand a practical way through it. Because I think part of the challenge, especially if you're really committed to saying, I want to be a Bible teacher, is sometimes you can give all of these formulas that nobody knows how to ground in a real life environment. So you go, here's the principle, and then here's a way I've played out the principle. You know, it might not tell you every part about the story, but enough that they go, oh, okay, that's how you do that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Okay. Very cool. Let's move on to number 7, as we're running short on time here, and we will link back to this so you can see more discussion and all the very insightful comments that are up there on that blog post. Number 7. You spend more. Oh no! I'm sorry. We're on number 6.
Number six. Right.
We measure ourselves by the numbers.
By the numbers.
Right. I am a data guy, a social scientific scholar of religion, and so we love gathering the data. But you know, I know pastors say, no. We never worry about how many seats are filled or anything like that. Of course you don't. But you do.
We do. I don't know of a single guy that could honestly say, we don't care about the numbers. I don't know of that guy. I know that there's guys that want to say, we shouldn't care about the numbers. Or, you know, or even it's a little bit cliche where people will leave a church and say, all they cared about was the numbers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a little cliche, too, because I go, there's a good side to numbers and there's a bad side to numbers, right? In the response to this, the follow-up, I said, you know, if they're Jesus's numbers, we should celebrate. And if they're my numbers, I should repent. You know, and that's the way I would kind of divvy it out. I think anything can have kind of a dark side and a light side to it. And so if you're saying, man, numbers are souls and we're just happy they're getting reached and that's fantastic and so many people responded to this thing and it's really not about your ego again, mm-hmm. it's really just you're thrilled about that, that's fantastic. I think where we get a little trapped as pastors sometimes is we start, again, assessing our value by the numbers, how many seats are filled or not filled, how many people are signing up or not signing up, am I pulling it off or not pulling it off, and that's the number game problem for us. And then, you know, it inflates our balloon or deflates our balloon based on those things. And then even though we all kind of hate that reality, it's that oddity of every time we meet a guy for the first time, the first question is, how big's your church?
Yeah.
You know,
no,
and
I
it's the
that.
Worst yep. question. It's the worst question. I'm like, why are we asking ourselves this? We all know we hate that issue because the answer is probably one of two things, right? And I've never met a guy almost ever that's like, it's in the decline, it's horrible, bro. You know what I mean? They don't say that, yeah. At least not within a 20-mile radius.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
When I've done the church tours throughout the state, I go to Spokane, 300 miles away. Those guys are more transparent.
Mm-hmm.
The dudes 20 miles away are not.
Yeah.
They're just not. You know, not in the same way because, again, we're all kind of jockeying, you know, because it's that's the cover of the book of the pastor right there. How big is your church? Is it growing? And every guy's like, yeah, we're growing.
That information is very important because, again, if the numbers start sliding, you got to stop and ask yourself, well, why are people leaving the church?
Exactly.
Is it something personal with me? Is it a message? Is there, you know, somebody else? And, you know, and I know, as you were just talking about this, a number of congregations, you know, some mainline congregations, we won't name names here, but, you know, their numbers are sliding. We see this in the data, and they say, you know, it's not us, it's the culture at large, right? So it's easy to pass that off to something else and just completely ignore any problems that are going on within the congregation, within the pastorate, or even the denomination at large.
Right. Yeah, and that's where I'm always wanting to be cautious to where it's saying, you know, there's a good side to the numbers, and then there's a bad side. And a lot of that's motivational. It's less about the actual keeping of numbers, right? So you're right, because there are metrics. So they let us know, is something going right, something going wrong? But I think even in that, there's a divide, because you can have a church that says, man, we grew by 1,000 people. And you're like, what's your secret? And they're like, it's all men. We put in a stripper pole. They love it. You know what I mean? So just because, you know, you have numbers doesn't even necessarily mean that you have health too. And I think that's where there's so much more to it to say, all right, what are our values in relationship to what are our numbers? And then what do those numbers tell us in the story? And using that as a tool. So like at Redemption Church, we actually take attendance. We actually keep the numbers. I refuse to look at them. Because, as I shared, I've struggled with more of an idolatry with numbers historically. So instead, I have another pastor that tracks the numbers, and what he comes to me with is, we're seeing a slide, so let's talk about it. You know, or we're seeing an increase, how did that happen? Right? So somebody else monitors to it. Because I think it's important to have somebody keeping track of the metrics. It's just, for me, I go, it really frees me to not worry about the metrics. You know, so you worry about the metrics, you let me know when I need to be concerned by the metrics, and then we can have that conversation. That's just my personal issue. Somebody said, is that how you solve it? No. I think another guy can look at the numbers and it's totally great. But for me, it kind of spared me some grief. Mm. At this point, I could probably look at it now. It'd be cool. I've just never come back around to looking. And I haven't looked for the entire duration of Redemption Church. I've never looked at the Sunday morning attendance at Redemption Church.
So we just talked attendance numbers here, but what about contributions?
Yeah, you know what? I personally do not look at that information except kind of the bottom line. So it's is giving higher than budgeted needs, you know, and how's the savings account? And I look at those big ideas. I do not look at individual congregants or, you know, giving trends, you know. And actually, I think that can be, again, a useful tool in shepherding. Like, suddenly if somebody just stops giving, that's usually a sign of a couple of things. Either A, there's a family crisis, and you could shepherd that. B, they're upset, and that's their protest.
Yeah.
You know, whatever else. And so I do think there's value in that. And we do have people within our team that have access to that and will say, like, hey, just FYI, so-and-so hasn't given for 4 months. Maybe we want to find out about why. And again, not as a judgment. It's not a condemnation. It's more, is everything okay?
Yeah.
You know? So it's a warning sign. I think some churches care way too much about money. And that's, they get driven by those numbers. And that's an unhealthy thing. But I think on the positive, when somebody maybe doesn't give for a while that used to, you can check in and make sure everything's going okay too. And that could be a positive part of that.
Yeah. These little signals of, you know, not showing up, not contributing, et cetera, et cetera, are just signs of other things that are going on, and they keep it in
like
that context.
And like I said, some can be protest, and some could be personal family problem, you know, and so you can hopefully be an encouragement there.
I should note that we do have a conversation with Larry Osborne that we recorded a couple years ago that talked about pastors and whether or not they should be looking at the financial numbers. We'll link back to that one. But onwards to number seven. So this has been some pretty heavy stuff here so far. Number seven might reflect that. You say pastors spend more time discouraged than encouraged. And this is very interesting because the public persona that you have to put on your face is always uplifting, right? Right. You can't be the Eeyore in the Winnie the Pooh things of ministry.
Yeah, you have to play Tigger a lot.
Yeah. In fact, I remember I went to a church out east one time, and I just showed up at a Presbyterian church because it was a Presbyterian country, and the minister was this Eeyore guy, just so downtrodden and depressed. And, you know, maybe he's given up on a lot of these things that you've talked about before, but that was a downer. So we're counting on you guys to always be encouraging, but you're saying yet you spend more time discouraged? What's up?
Yeah, well, I think that goes back in part to the transparency versus opaque issue, that sometimes you have to come in and, you know what, you have a message of hope, and you're jived about it, right?
Yeah.
As you were agonizing before you walked out on the platform, and then you go off and you just lay down on the floor for 5 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are those things where you're meant to communicate and embody something that's true, but you don't always feel that way. And I think on this point in particular, I think guys whose job is more the vision or direction of the church, they probably suffer the most under this. I think all ministry leaders are going to have some sense of this, but I think they uniquely suffer under it because part of their job is to say, what else needs to be fixed? A lot of their job isn't to celebrate, oh, that's working well and that's working well. You're trying to figure out, what do we need to deal with next? What do we need to refine or change? Or what is the problem over here that we haven't analyzed? And so you feel like a lot of your mission is always looking out to what it should be and never enjoying what it is. So I think that's in part why you can be discouraged a lot of the time, because it's always what isn't yet. And then sadly, when you finally get there and it is, you're already on to what isn't again. So I think that's a part of the discouragement that chiefly can plague it. I think other things are just all these things accumulated, right? So if people are leaving and you feel like you're not performing and this isn't what you thought it was going to be and everything else, and those things can all pop in at different points over the course of ministry. So you end up finding more discouragement at times than encouragement. And you're always trying to see it become what it's supposed to be, and you just miss on them what it is.
One of the other things I've oftentimes wondered about is your role as a counselor, that a lot of people come to you with some pretty heavy burdens, and you take those on your shoulders. And I can imagine that just piles up over time, is that, you know, not only do pastors have their daily burdens that they have to go through, all these things we've been talking about, but they feel they have to carry other people's burdens. Is that part of this?
No,
too?
Absolutely. I mean, even like this last week, we had a good friend of ours in the church pass away, unexpected, you know, an accident. And so it's Easter week, right? It's like your Super Bowl Sunday.
Right.
And we're putting together a memorial and we're spending time with our friend who lost her husband, and you know, all, and you're just weighted down and you're tearful and all of that, but you're going into, and he's risen, you know?
Yeah.
So there is a lot of that. And, you know, people have marital issues and kid issues and everything else that you're dealing with on top of it. So there is a lot of emotional, weighty things all happening behind the scenes. And then you're still supposed to get up and, you know, be energized and jazzed, and, you know, it's always, you're always happy every week, you know, and everything else.
And also you think the message is getting across, and you look at the audience, they got their hands waved, they're clapping during the songs, but then one-on-one you're hearing, oh, maybe the message is not getting through. I mean, I have the same thing with teaching, right? It's like, boy, just, you know, the shiny faces out there in the audience, everybody got this point. And then you look at the midterm exam. Oh, man, was I speaking Martian?
Right.
What was I saying?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
So that must be something you got to deal with too. How do you manage it? How do you manage that?
You know, on that one, I mean, it's a little bit more like I do a couple of different things, but the primary thing I try to do is I want to go and talk to a guy that has it tougher than I do. You know what I mean? So in other words, you know, I'm at a church that has a surplus in its bank account right now, has a great team to work with. The people are phenomenal. You know, I'm in a really amazing church, right? And then I start to whimper about, I wish it was like this, and it needs to be like that. We still got to get a building. You know, I just have my little complaints, right? So then I go and I talk to my friend down the road, who's in a church of maybe 60 or 70, is just fighting for every single person. having to do every job in the church, right? And I'm like, man, I got it good. I mean, like, if I was in that dude's shoes, that's hard. I mean, I respect that guy. That guy's having to swing harder for the fence than I do. And then it suddenly makes me go like, man, I'm blessed. Suddenly, I shouldn't be complaining at all.
I hear you, and I do the same exact thing, right? You say the grass is always greener on the other side, but then you go and peek over at some other neighbors, and you see, no, their grass hasn't been watered in 3 years, right? It's looking pretty bad. But that just seems like such a crappy solution. I'm feeling bad, so let's go find somebody else who's worse.
I know,
worse.
It really does. It sounds very opportunistic of me, right? Like, I'm going to find a guy. You know, but it's funny because I find a lot of those guys are, you know, they're, oddly enough, they're often more grateful even for their situation at times too. You know what I mean? Like, they're not complaining about their problem, and they're just working hard to do what they do. And I'm like, man, because I think in part it gets back to the purity of what ministry kind of is. I mean, here's a guy, you know, probably not making a very decent salary, doing every job that there is, and gratefully doing it. And it reminds me, like, yeah, wait a minute. You know, my belly aching about these different things are really silly, because, you know, this isn't about making sure we have enough in the bank account and making sure we have a building down the road and all of that stuff. It's like, you know, what is this really all about? You know, it's about Jesus and his church and his kingdom, and it's not about, frankly, empire building, which pastors will struggle with that. Mm-hmm. We will struggle with empire building. We want to see things grow, and we want to pat ourselves on the back for that growth sometimes. Now, we're all going to pass the Bible quiz that says, nope, Jesus does it, and the Holy Spirit, you know, is at work. And we believe that. But there's this other part of it that we'll judge other pastors too. We'll be like, see, that guy's never going to grow that church because 70s doesn't work for a sanctuary, you know? And that guy's as dry as dirt in Africa. And so we're still kind of making those assessments, and we forget some of the purity again, I think, of the ministry pursuit.
Now, as you mentioned this too, I was thinking Paul in the Roman prisons. Right?
Yeah.
You know, that's another place I guess you could go. Because I was thinking when you wrote this, I go, there's got to be that Eeyore guy. There's the one pastor that everybody gets to go to. It's the worst pastor in the world, the most miserable one. So we're going to appoint somebody that so all the other pastors can go to him. I go, that must be a horrible job. But you kind of think about this. You go, well, you know, Paul was kind of that guy in the New Testament, right?
Yeah, because there's the other flip of that, right? So you find the guy that, you know, isn't enjoying it, and that doubly makes you happy. You know, I mean, not for him, but for you. Like, and wow, I could be miserable like that guy too. You know, I could be doubly irritated. Yeah. You know, so I think, you know, for everybody, they kind of solve it a different way. But for me, I find that if I go back and I talk to one of those guys that is just having to labor harder, and yet he's getting it done, and he's got a spring to step even trying to do that. That does. It really centers me again. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I get the big picture again in my head.
Very cool. Number 8. Here we are moving on. You worry about what we think. So one of your big concerns is we worry about what you think. Now, this one is a surprise to me because I was sitting there and go, why wouldn't a pastor want to reveal it? I want you to worry about what I think. Isn't that your job? So Explain this one.
Yeah, this one is probably a little bit more narrow when I originally put it together, which is there are times where you get up on a Sunday morning and you say, you give an announcement that you don't really want to give because you know people are going to be like, oh, really? You know, you're doing that. We don't approve of that. Or you're going to preach a passage of the Bible that you know a good chunk of the people out there are going to be like, well, we don't approve of that message, you know, whatever it is. You know, it might be something about sexuality, or it might be something about marriage that is not popular in the culture but is clear to the Bible. Or maybe it's going to be an announcement like when you let a staff member go, like we did this year, and you go, man, this is going to go down like a jagged pill with no water. And so all of those things make you go, I am really concerned about what they're going to think, right? And for some guys, they'll be so concerned, they don't do it. You know, some guys will be so concerned about how people view them or will receive them that they refuse to do things that are hard. But I think there's other guys that get up there and be like, this is how it is, and bam, and they move on. And people are like, well, that guy's a jerk. You know what I mean? Like, he just kind of, you know, hit us in the face with it and acted like it doesn't affect him at all and moves on. And my thing is to say, even when we get up there and we say something with confidence and conviction and courage, and it seems like, you know what, you can like it or hate it, we don't care, we're just saying it. No, most of us actually are weighed down, I think, when we say something that isn't going to be popular or well-received potentially. We'll probably still say it, but we're not callous to the fact that you're going to have to receive it. And that might be a hard deal to take down. And so it's because I do think there's really, especially when you get more prophetic type personalities that are just like, this is the truth. You need to accept it. That people can be like, does he wrestle at all with this himself? Does he find this problematic? One of the things I try to share is there's things in the Bible I don't like, but it wins. And that's a way I often preface something that's going to be difficult to swallow is I'll be like, I don't like this either, and it wins. You know, and so that's a little bit of that transparency that
yeah,
says,
I was going to connect that
I
back.
Get that this is going to be hard for you to accept. It's hard for me to accept, and it still wins.
Yeah, so that's your primary technique of dealing with that. It's just kind of like, listen.
At least on a Sunday morning kind of thing. Yeah. Or if it's going to be something really hard that's more what I'd call a family discussion. You know what I mean? So like an announcement of letting somebody go or something like that. I'll actually take a bar stool and just set it down and sit on the bar stool and be like, here's something that's going to be tough for us to swallow. I'm not trying to do this as a presenter. Now I'm doing this as a friend trying to share a conversation. And so that'll be a way I do it too.
Do you find that you have to really think about this hard too on one-on-one consultations? Do you have to think about how you give the tough love approach? If the tough love is part of it. I face this as an instructor too. I know that you have to go and tell students, listen, you failed. I know that you don't want to fail and you want to go to law school or this and that and the other thing. But by the way, I'm not going to raise your grade because this failure is good for you. And you know they don't want to say that. And I know a lot of professors that say, well, yeah, we'll just erase that F and give you a B plus. Is that okay? Just so you can go away. And there's been those temptations is that a burden there too?
Yeah, because I think sometimes what can happen, you get different personality types, but I think there's some personality types that are more concerned with communicating what the message is than being concerned about the person receiving it. So they're just happy that they delivered the mail, and they don't care whether you like it or don't like it. And I think that's a harmful thing. I think we can deliver the mail better when we're actually hoping that they read it. You know what I mean? So if I'm in a counseling situation and I'm having to address something where, let's say, somebody's pursuing divorce and the reasons are really self-absorbed and it's going to be completely devastating, I don't want to just sit down and say, like, hey, man, divorce is sin, so repent. You know, I'm like, okay, dude, let's talk. You know, divorce, yeah, it's sin. Here's the implications. Here's the stuff. And I get it. Your marriage may not be going well, and maybe it's been building for a while, and help me understand more. I'm still saying in the end, like, this is not the road to go down, but I'm not just like, bam, move on.
Yeah.
If you like it, great. If not, get out of my office. You know, I want them to read the mail, right? So I think it's trying, when you think about being concerned about them receiving it, we worry about what they think, that can be a good motivator to say, so let's communicate it in a way that they'll receive it. Where it's a bad motivator is where you say, kind of like with a professor, I'll just erase the F and give them a B plus.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna wuss out at the last second, veer off, and not say anything. Just like, hey, I just wanted to say hi, bro.
It makes your life a lot easier, but it makes their life a lot worse. Yeah, and there's that temptation. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna go ahead and encapsulate the last two ones that you have here just for sake of time, but we've discussed a number of these already. Number 9 is we struggle with competition and jealousy. And then number 10, we feel like we failed you more than we have helped you. Go ahead and give your thoughts on those.
Yeah, on the competition one, you know, obviously we shared that there can be good and bad competition. That one's definitely related to the bad competition problem, right? So you see the
new church down the street that has big fancy parking lot.
Whatever it is, has all this great amenity, and you're like, oh, come on, man, you know? And it's hard because, you know, it's like, I wrote recently about if you're a small church in the shadow of a big church, don't try to become the big church because Chuck E. Cheese is awesome until it's next to Disneyland. You know, and then Chuck E. Cheese is cute and kind of ridiculous when it's right next to Disneyland. And so don't try to be that. But the problem is you're going to feel a competition because everybody's like, oh, we're going to the place that has, the indoor playland that's the size of your church next door.
Right.
You know, and so you're going to feel a bit jealous and competitive, you know, and trying to kind of resist that as much as possible and find what is it that Jesus calls you to? You know, what is it that he wants you to accomplish with the tools that he's given you to accomplish? But I think a pastor is always going to struggle with that sense of, wow, you know, come on, how do we match up? How do we do the same thing? And in the negative of it, I mean, you can learn from in the positive, right? So you can be like, oh, they're doing that. That's cool. How can we do something like that? And we're not doing it to chase them. we're doing it because we think it's cool, you know? Mm-hmm. But as soon as it becomes I'm chasing again, then it's a. I think you're going to chase hard and probably be pretty disappointed in the end, too.
Is there any motivation to actually embrace the parts that you might be inadequate in? I mean, I find I do this quite often, too. I think I'm pretty good at large lecture classes, but I'm not very good with one-on-one counseling with students. And so I kind of embrace it like, oh, yeah, you're going to come to me one-on-one counseling. I'm horrible on that. You know, and that's not my thing. I would love to be better because I see the professor two doors down in the hallway. They're awesome with that. They're always working with students, and I wish I could do that. But, you know, there's a point in time I just have to say that ain't me.
Right.
And I'm going to have to write that off.
Yeah, I think if somebody can round the corner and get to that point, they're going to be way healthier for it. You know, I think if it's just perpetually resentment, you know, like, I'm not that, but I'm mad that everybody goes to that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you're just going to be burdened again. You're going to end up, and that's my concern. I think one of the hardest things that I find pastors struggle with is letting go of bitterness that kind of accrues over the course of time because these different things are in play and they're never closed. They remain like these open windows or pop-ups on their computer of their mind, and they don't close them out, and then over the they just get more bitter and more bitter and more resentful, and this is not the way I thought it was going to go. And you know, and so when even a good thing and a church down the road that they could celebrate, because they're never going to do that, instead they're just mad that it exists. And they see that even that thing just takes more people away from their church. So I think if a guy gets bitter like that, he's in bad shape. Really bad shape.
I actually see this a lot with Christians online, too. They're always nitpicking each other at different churches on Facebook. And I, you know, and I admittedly, I have this problem, too, in my own profession. I see so-and-so gets that and this and the other thing. I was like, why can't I do that? And,
yeah.
You know, it's like, well, since I can't do that, it must not be very important and
right.
And that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's a tough one to struggle with.
Yeah.
How about this last one? We feel like we failed you more than we have helped you.
Yeah, I think this one is related to, you know, most pastors, they'll go to a conference, read a book, watch some personality online, you know, some video series or whatever else, and they see the success stories, right? And then they measure themselves against the success story. So they'll look at a Mars Hill and be like, Mark Driscoll planted that with like 12 people, 7 of which were probably high school dropouts, you know, and now it's 15,000 people in 15 locations. And you go, well, everybody should be able to do that,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you're not coming close to it. You know, I mean, there's just no way. You know, I mean, it's such a small percentage of the overall church landscape that you then feel like, well, I guess I'm just not accomplishing. I'm not good at this, you mm-hmm. know, because if he can do it, why can't I do it? And I think it's in part promoted by the fact that most churches, when they hire a guy, they'll have their, you know, list of this is what we're looking for. And it always says the same thing. We're looking for a person to take us to the next level.
Yeah.
So you're constantly measured against in your mind, am I taking them to the next level? And if you don't feel that you are, if the church stays plateaued for 3 years, 5 years, 6 months, well, we're not racing with the wind. We're taking on water. You know, you go the negative route instead of the, hey, we're stable. That's good. You just go.
We haven't lost anybody.
Yeah, to be flatlined is to be dying.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So you impose that on you more and you just go, man, I'm just more discouraged than encouraged because it feels like flat lines or shrinking phases are more common probably than growth spikes and upward trends, I think, in the average local church. You have the anomalies like a Mars Hill or, you know, you pick your big, you know, Rick Warren and Saddleback, and you see those things and you aspire to that. I think every person that goes into ministry, they wanted to conquer the world. They want to be in a big church. There's guys I meet that say, you know, I'm not interested in a mega church, but you know what? If their church became a mega church, they wouldn't be like, oh, let's change this tomorrow.
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean?
They're going to be like, very successful in your message. No, that's not a good thing.
No,
you're supposed to get more people.
Right.
You're supposed to reach more people, right?
So I think even the guys that say, I don't want a mega church, are just guarding they're guarding themselves from the fact that they know that's probably not going to be true.
Lowering expectations.
Yeah, they lower the expectations. Yeah. But I think every pastor I've ever met would love that, you know? And that's funny because the guys that have that, this list is just as true for them, and the burdens are bigger. You know what I mean? Like, let's say your church gets to 5,000. You know how much pressure it is
mm-hmm.
to keep to try
that
to get to
momentum
10?
Going.
You know?
And then you got you got more people nitpicking you on every possible thing,
I mean,
and your family life.
You've got counter anti like fan clubs that just despise you online. You know, and you just exacerbate the weight of it when you have one. So you never win on either end of the spectrum. Little church guy struggles with it. Big church guy struggles with it. It's all kind of the same game.
So how do you deal with that? I liked your response here, and I think this is a nice way to wrap up, because you say when we feel like we failed you more than we helped you, and again, from the congregate point of view, we don't necessarily see that. We leave, you know, church going, oh, that was pretty good, you know, I really like that, and this, you know, little do we know that you walk back into your office and go, oh, I failed everybody again. So how do you deal with it?
Yeah, so in my follow-up too, I said, I try to talk less and preach more. And what I mean by that, I don't mean preach to the church, but I mean, you know, how we can all have those conversations in our mind. You know, let's say you're dealing with a problem or a person that's a problem, and you argue with them 50 times in your head, and you beat them every time with that zinger, and you just keep playing the argument over and over and over in your head. Well, that's what I call talking to ourselves. So it's us building our argument, or even sometimes criticism in this case. We're criticizing ourselves. I don't do this right. I didn't do that right. I should have done this better. People don't do this, and people don't do that. And if we just had more money, and you get all those things. So that's talking to yourself. And what I try to do is stop talking to myself and start preaching to myself, which is I just start literally out loud quoting Bible verses to myself. So I, instead of this indigenous counsel that I'm giving myself that's negative, I go, what does the Bible say in relationship to my problem? So if I'm mad at people because they're not helping and sticking around or whatever else, I go, whoa, man, love your enemies, dude. That's what Jesus says, you know, in Matthew 5, or you know, whatever other problem it is, you know. Man, church is just losing ground in our culture. That's a favorite one right now.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Church is losing ground in our culture. And I go back to Matthew 16, 18. Whoa, the gates of hell can't prevail against the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I just preach to myself.
Do you preach to yourself, or does that message come out to everybody else too?
I think it eventually then comes out to everybody else. I think, you know, I think anytime you're reminding yourself of what God has said that's contrary to whatever opinions you want to generate, it does inflate you. It's like, that's right. That's what's true. And then inevitably, that's what's coming out on Sunday. The flip is, if you're not preaching to yourself and you're just listening to yourself, you're just talking and listening, your own indigenous, broken whatever, that will come out too on Sunday. Or in other venues, you know, you'll start to be the Eeyore, and you'll start to be the naysayer, and you'll start to act as though all is lost and there's no future and everything else, or you'll just quit. And that comes, not quit literally, just quit trying. And then everybody will see, like, he's just lost something. The fire, the passion, the want is gone. What's going on? I think people do read their pastors pretty well at that level.
Yeah.
They'll know when it's not going right.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen those pastors.
So I think that is the key to preach to yourself more and talk to yourself less, is just get back to what's true.
Well, that seems to be pretty good advice to end up here. Just keep on preaching. That's what we're doing here on Research on Religion, as we're coming up to 200 episodes. And we want to thank our guests.
200.
200.
Congratulations,
I know,
man.
It's been
That's
4 years.
Fantastic.
It is really cool. So
yeah.
We're going to keep on preaching. You're going to keep on preaching. And we want to thank Matt Boswell for being our guest on Research on Religion.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.